Hello and welcome to Cooper Talks USA, episode 6, in what will be the first of 3 episodes looking at the issue of party politics in the USA and why they have become so partisan and that change over time. So the first issue really to look at is there a modern divide? And I think most people would go that yes, American party politics today is very much in the partisan mold. We have the Democrats and the Republicans clearly occupying different spheres and effectively campaigning and arguing directly with each other with very little in the way of bipartisan control. There's lots and lots of evidence for this, most notably the government shutdown, which was caused by a Republican refusal in 2013 to pass the budget unless there was defunding of the Affordable Care Act, which obviously the Democrats weren't supporting. We can look at other aspects of the budget shutdown and the issues over the raising of the debt ceiling. We can look at the hostility to Obama's Iran mission statements, the hostility towards some of the Democrat policies to do with finance, minimum wage and so on, versus the Republican positions on things like abortion and homosexuality and other issues. And there is a great deal of hostility and divide between the two parties, and there's very little sense of cooperation these days. According to the various data that's available, in the Senate, at least, there is no Democrat who is more conservative than the most liberal Republican, meaning that there is a clear divide between the two. And in the House, there's one or two possible exceptions, but by and large, the most conservative Democrat is more liberal than the most liberal Republican. So we have this clear divide between the two. That comes through in the way politics runs in the primary debates. It's all about the Democrats versus the Republicans with clear hostility and a refusal to bridge those gaps. What's perhaps striking in the modern world is that according to most of the survey data that's done, your average American is moderate in their positions. So while the Democrats have been shifting to the left and the Republicans have been shifting to the right, what's been left behind is middle America, or the majority of America. When asked their position on things like abortion, say, most Americans actually go with the opinion that they would support abortion in certain circumstances. This was probably best seen by a sort of collation of the various Gallup polls that have been taken on the issue of abortion. And covering the period 1975 to 2013, what's remarkable is the average opinion has stayed much the same, with around, well, between 50 and 60% of Americans asked saying that abortion should be legal under certain circumstances. And the extremist positions, if you like, legal under any circumstances, normally fits between 20 and 30% of the population. And those thinking illegal in all circumstances, usually between about 20 and 10% of the population. Which sort of suggests what we've been saying. You can also see in other data that when it comes to identifying themselves either as extremely liberal, moderate, conservative, or extremely conservative, less than 5% of Americans would call themselves extremely liberal or extremely conservative. And perhaps the most common throughout most of the history of America from the 70s to around 2012, most Americans would call themselves either moderate or conservative. So moderate to conservative. And that would make up about 25 to 30% of the population, with moderate to liberal coming in at about 15 to 20%. The average American is moderate and middle of the road. And there is a belief, or a sort of harking back to a time when there was bipartisan cooperation and the two parties fought for this middle average voter. And you won elections by appealing to the centre ground, to the average. And that period really covers the 1930s to the 1960s. So this is what we're going to call the bipartisanship era, 1930s to 1960s. But why? Why was this period marked by such cooperation? The first thing to note is that the 1930s to 60s were marked really by three major events. The first being the Great Depression and the reaction to that. The second being World War II. And the third being the origins of the Cold War. And these had an effect of forcing both parties to the centre, to a period of bipartisan cooperation. Now, the first reason this happened was the Great Depression. Because of the almost, well, because the Republicans were in power during the boom time of the 1920s, and because the Republicans were therefore given the blame when the crash happened, the 1930 midterms, and then on into the 1932, 34, and 1936 elections, the Republican Party was pretty much wiped out as a national party, replaced by a huge number of Democrats, all supporting FDR's, Franklin Roosevelt's positions on greater government involvement, greater government spending, and taking action to alleviate the Depression. So we got this shift to the left in national politics in response to the crisis of the Depression. And that left essentially Congress for much of the period of the 1930s under the control of one party. And the Republicans became essentially a sideshow. Now, when the Republicans started coming back as a political force, the new Republicans won seats by appealing or accepting Democrat policies. So what you had was a situation where most of the conservative, certainly fiscally conservative Republicans, were removed from office through electoral defeat. And when the new wave of Republicans came in, they won election by moving to the centre, by becoming more liberal and accepting these social policies. So if you like, the new image of the Republican Party that came through in the 1930s and 40s was one that was much more centrist, much more moderate, and much more in line with New Deal thinking. And the evidence that the New Deal was popular come from Roosevelt's successive re-elections. Whether or not he remained as popular throughout the period as he was in 1932 and 1936 is in some debate. But clearly he and the New Deal were popular, and the Republican parties, to remain a viable force, had to accept that. Towards the end of the New Deal, perhaps when you'd argue the Republicans might be coming back as a force, we get World War II. And that great national crisis meant that both sides unified together. And there was a belief in cooperation, of unanimity, in fighting the common enemies of Nazism, fascism, and the Japanese threat after Pearl Harbor. And because of that unifying force, the two parties remained very similar in the way the war was prosecuted and in plans for the future. So we've got two things have come through. One, the external threat has kept the parties together after they were brought together by the economic threat to people at home. And after World War II, both parties, by and large, supported the same positions in terms of the Cold War. Although there may be disagreement over the success or the way exactly they did it, US involvement in Cold War affairs marked a period of cooperation between the two. And in foreign issues, such as the Korean War, by and large, the two main parties fully agreed. So we had this acceptance of the New Deal domestic policies, and we had bipartisan cooperation in foreign policy. So there was very little to disagree with. One thing to remember about this period of the 1930s to the 1960s, and this period of bipartisanship that people hark back to, and they say, oh, with all the partisan catastrophes, can't we go back to bipartisan cooperation with the parties working together? Two things to remember. One, there were people at the time who bemoaned this bipartisanship, who felt it was a bad thing for democracy when there was no distinction between the two parties. Who do you choose in the election if they both stand for the same? And so there were a number of people and commentators who thought this was bad at the time. So compromise might be nice, but it doesn't necessarily lead to proper competition and democratic debate. The second and perhaps more interesting thing is this is very much the anomaly in American history. Although it might seem a wonderful time, compare it to the early years of the Republic when issues were fought between the Federalists and, I suppose, the Republicans, as they were called, but not the modern Republican Party, over the nature of the American future. Should it be a federal system, or should it be a local state-based system? Where does the power lie? In a strong central government with a national bank holding everything up, or should it be left to the individual states? And look at the early clashes between the different parties over the creation of the national bank, and we see partisan politics playing a role. Although the Federalist Party dies away, we then see it again with Andrew Jackson and his Democracy Party coming through in and the Whigs in opposition. And again, the role of government, big federal government versus big state government and small intervention, the second national bank crisis. And then even after the Jacksonian era ends, we get the crises and the partisan struggles over the expansion of slavery, which will eventually tear America apart in the Civil War. Even after Reconstruction, after the Civil War, we get bipartisan opposition with the Democrats, mostly centred on the South, but elsewhere defending the working class and the poor, with the Republican Party at the time, the Gilded Age Republicans, favouring the business interests of the North, the new corporations and the industrialised aspects. And so we get this big partisan struggle going right the way through until the 1930s, when major crises forced the two parties to come very close to the same ground. So the 1930s to 60s were very much an anomaly in American politics, and the situation we have today is much more the norm. But how do we get from that period to now? Well, the seeds of the modern dysfunction were already evident in the 1930s to 60s. And the first thing to look at is the Democrat Party itself. And in the 1930s to 1960s, the Democrat Party was really two parties in one. You had the party of the New Deal Coalition, a party with a high proportion of African-American supporters who'd been helped during the Depression and into World War II, who were more liberal, more socially aware, and seeking big federal government spending. But within the same party, you had what were called the Dixiecrats, those southern, very conservative Democrats who were fiscally liberal and at the time certainly enjoyed federal grants and federal spending. Just look at the TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority, as an example of that. But on social and moral issues were very, very conservative. Obviously, very pro-segregation by and large, and racial discrimination, but also in terms of religion and culture, very, very conservative. And so this tension emerged within the Democrat Party. And Roosevelt, Truman, and even Kennedy had to sort of compromise and keep these two factions relatively unified. And what that meant was often the Republican Party were essentially a third party that could create the balance of power in Congress. So on certain issues, economic issues, perhaps you might get the Liberal Democrats or the centrist Democrats and the Dixiecrats working together. But on social policies, you might get the Dixiecrats and the Liberal Democrats fighting for the Republican Party to support them, trying to gain their support on various issues. So in some ways, you actually had, throughout the 1950s and into 60s, you actually had a sort of three-party system with this huge umbrella covering the Democrats and a much smaller group of rump Republicans who were generally fiscally conservative but socially liberal, and they would play off the other two sides to try and achieve a desired goal. And so it's perhaps unsurprising that we get such a period of bipartisan cooperation when the Democrats are effectively split in half and the Republicans cooperate with either of the two factions to achieve their goals. Now, at the same time, during the 1930s to 60s, as mentioned, the Republicans were shifting to the left in order to make themselves relevant as a national party. So they were accepting most of the fiscal welfare spending, things like Social Security, Medicare and Medicaid. They would accept those programs and support them. And actually, Eisenhower, a nominally Republican president, actually expanded the spending and spending on Social Security far more than Truman or Kennedy would. So there's an acceptance and an extension of left-wing Democrat policies, which go through this whole period, because the Republicans realised in order to win elections, they had to appeal to the electorate. So they shifted to the left because that's what people supported up until the 1960s. So to think of it on a sort of sliding scale, you effectively had the Dixiecrats on the right, the Liberal Democrats on the left, and within their political spectrum sat the entire Republican Party. So the most liberal and the most conservative members of Congress were all in the Democrat Party. And the Republicans were actually a middle temporizing ground, and they were the bridge between the two factions. And often symbolized by a Republican president, well, say often, Eisenhower symbolized this as a bridge, common phrase that was used, a bridge between the different factions to try and make things work. One other thing that's worth bearing in mind, and a point noted by the scholars McCallum and Clues, is that the period of the 1950s and 60s, well, the 1940s and 1950s, is marked by the absence of social movements. What I mean by that is there were no major internal threats in American politics. Now, of course, there were lots and lots of minor things, and some of you are probably already saying, well, what about the civil rights movement? And I'll come to that shortly. But there weren't any major movements or issues dividing the American population during this period. On the whole, most Americans got behind the New Deal. And while there were exceptions, of course, there was no mass movement in opposition to the New Deal. When World War II got going, yes, there were some people who did not support it or did not approve of the way it was being prosecuted, but the vast majority of Americans got behind the government and supported. There was no division, there was no major anti-war movement. And then when the Cold War begins, again, most Americans supported. There is this hostility towards communism, there is this fear of the atomic arms race, and there is this desire to support Truman and Eisenhower in extending the rhetoric and becoming much more militant on the issue of the Cold War and standing up to Russia and trying to keep the Western Europe safe from communist threats. There was no major, well, let's support the communist movement or anti-Cold War movement in America. And issues like opposition to nuclear weapons were very small and almost non-existent throughout this period. What that meant was the two parties were safe to focus on the centre ground, to focus on that middle ground of American politics, and there wasn't an issue to throw them off centre, to force them to the left or force them to the right. They could just happily sit in the middle, appealing to the same voters on very similar issues, with very little to distinguish between them, other than perhaps personality. If we look at the one social movement that did start to gain some traction in the 1950s, it would be the civil rights movement. And again, something to consider here is the civil rights movement was not on a continuous spectrum, in that it did not gather momentum in the 1950s and then continue to grow into the 1960s. Instead, there was a spike in the social movement, a spike that ended effectively in 1957. So we started with Rosa Parks and the bus boycotts, and that led to a bipartisan bill in Congress in 1957, which gave some small measure of rights and protection in civil rights. It was significant for being a civil rights piece of legislation, but in terms of what it actually achieved, was very, very minor. And then after that, the civil rights movement as a national concern fades from the public eye. Yes, it's still going on and it doesn't disappear, but as a major political issue, it ceases to be in the national media, and it's not something most voters and even the parties are considering until we get to the mid-1960s. It's not until 1963 that it yet again becomes a major political issue. So with the exception of that civil rights movement, and that brief or that spike in civil rights activity, there are no major social movements throughout the 40s and 50s to really push the two parties apart. That's probably best reflected in the 1960 election, where on civil rights, on social policy, on economic policy, on Cold War international policy, John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon pretty much had identical platforms. There was almost nothing to choose between them on any issue, because there were no other, you know, there were no divisive issues or movements in American politics at the time. However, 1960 is a very interesting election, and it sort of sets the tone and reveals the bipartisan problems that are going to emerge during the 60s. Before I go into a bit of depth on the 1960 election itself, just want to give you a bit of the electoral history. I mentioned earlier that the Democrat Party at this time was essentially two parties in one. You had the sort of liberal New Deal coalition with a lot of black support in the North and a lot of working class and social support, a lot of working class white people as well, and immigrant support in the North. And in the South, you had the very conservative white majority who were pro-segregation, but also in favour of some of the social policies. And these two lived in an uneasy coalition during the New Deal era and on into the 1950s. However, it was uneasy, and there were early signs that the middle ground, the centre, would not hold. You have to have a bit of historical knowledge here. The South had remained loyal to the Democrat Party ever since the Civil War. The Democrat Party had been the one that had favoured states' rights, which is certainly during the Civil War and segregation was code for segregation and slavery. And they despised the party of Lincoln, so the Republican Party. So famously, there was the joke that a yellow dog could stand for election as a Democrat in the southern states and it would win election. So a yellow dog Democrat. But the Republicans just wouldn't win there. They couldn't win there. And we see that throughout a number of elections. It's the South that the Democrats hold. They might not win anywhere else, but the southern states, particularly the Deep South, would not vote Republican for any issue. But during the New Deal coalition, the tensions start to emerge as urban, working class black voters come into the New Deal coalition and seek some equality. Now, Roosevelt and Truman deal with this by basically fudging the issue, sort of suggesting they might do things, but they're never actually doing them and treading a fine line. But interestingly, the early signs of a revolt occurred as far back as 1948. Now, this was a famous election where Harry Truman was expected to lose, but managed to win. But for the first time, a number of southern states did not vote for the Democrat Party. There was a third party challenge led by the southern, at the time, Democrat Senator Strom Thurmond, called the States' Rights Party. Now, the States' Rights Party, again, that's code for the pro-segregation party, they ran and they won the states of Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama, so sort of some of the hardcore Deep South, and picked up about 2.4% of the vote. On its own, perhaps that means nothing. It's relatively small. But it shows that the Democrat Party were losing some of the support from the South. They couldn't bank on the southern states always remaining loyal to them. Fast forward to 1952, Eisenhower and Nixon win in a landslide, defeating the Democrat candidate Adlai Stevenson by a landslide. And the only states to vote Democrat were the southern states, by and large. Virginia and Tennessee voted Republican, but all the other southern states, and Florida and Texas as well, but most of the southern states, particularly the Deep South states, voted Democrat. They still could not bring themselves to vote Republican, even a popular Republican like Eisenhower. Now, fast forward to 1960. A very, very close election. And there was another third-party challenge from the very conservative Democrat Party, led by Harry Byrd and with his vice presidential nominee, Strom Thurmond. They only managed to win the state of Mississippi, so limited appeal. But you look at the rest of the electoral map and you look at the percentages and you realise Kennedy barely won. He got 49.7% of the vote nationally to Richard Nixon's 49.5. He won by 303 electoral college votes to 219, with Mississippi's 15 going to Byrd and Thurmond. But that winning margin is deceptive in the electoral college. Kennedy only won because of urban black voters in places like Chicago and New York and Boston and Philadelphia, which meant in some of those key states, he just about managed to win. There's a lot of controversy about actually did Kennedy win in Chicago? Did Mayor Daley of Chicago destroy a lot of Republican votes? Was there influence? We don't know. But he just about managed to win Illinois and other states like New York and Pennsylvania. And the solid South. The southern states, apart from Mississippi, all went for Kennedy. So Kennedy's won just thanks to liberal, unemployed, working class black Americans in the North and the southern Dixiecrats in the South. And he's got to try and find a way of holding it all together. And this is where he comes up against the revitalized civil rights movement. So in the early 60s, the civil rights movement gained serious traction. By 1963, Martin Luther King's delivering the I Have a Dream speech. There's images of Selma, there's images of Bull Connor turning the hoses and dogs onto unarmed, innocent civilians and children in Birmingham, in Alabama. And these things all lead to the growth and the national awareness of the civil rights movement. So while in 1960 Kennedy was able to tread the middle line and by and large keep the southern states, the Dixiecrats, and the northern black vote on his side, in the same way that Truman and FDR had managed, by 1963 the growth of the civil rights movement and the awareness of the civil rights movement was basically throwing the Democrat Party off the center platform. So if you imagine it was whirling around the centre, picking up middle ground votes, the civil rights movement tips the Democrats. And the Democrats fall, if you like, to the left. Now the consequences of that come through in 1964. Now, again, it's difficult to be clear why exactly it happened. It wasn't that suddenly all Democrats decided, yay, we're going to support civil rights. Obviously, the Kennedy assassination had a lot to do with this, and it was the Kennedy assassination and the attempts to fulfill Kennedy's legacy that that led to Johnson forcing through and really pushing through the 1964 Civil Rights Act. The civil rights legislation Kennedy had introduced before that was, it's worth remembering, effectively dying in Congress. It was going nowhere. It was very unlikely to succeed. So I suppose, if you like, his assassination had a positive effect for civil rights legislation. It's debatable whether it would have been passed without Kennedy's assassination. At the same time, other liberal proposals that have been suggested by Kennedy start to be pushed through by Johnson. So what are the effects of this liberal agenda that comes through in the year or so after Kennedy is assassinated? Well, this is the moment where the Dixiecrats really start to break away from the Democrat Party and start to look for independent challenges. It's not quite the third party movement yet, but they are looking for another party. The solid South that used to reliably vote Democrat and would never vote for the party of Lincoln starts looking for a more extreme answer. So what's happened by 1964 is that the Democrats have been pushed away from the moderate centre ground by the civil rights issue, and they lose a chunk of their southern support. So a lot of those conservative aspects of the Democrat Party start to break away and become less loyal to them. And of course, I suppose the way to think about that is, if you imagine there's the liberal Democrats as a weight on one side of a poll, and then on the other side of the poll, pulling it in the other direction, were the Dixiecrats. And this kept the Democrat poll centred in the middle. Now, of course, with the civil rights movement pushing the liberal wing further to the left, it causes the Dixiecrats to drop off. And without that weight, the Liberal Democrats are free to go further to the left. And boy, did they under Johnson in his second term. Of course, at the same time that the Democrats were shifting further to the left, the Republican Party starts to react to it. And what was notable is there was a big battle in the 1964 primaries between Nelson Rockefeller, who was seen as a very moderate compromise, very close to Johnson on many social and racial issues, and a man called Barry Goldwater, who was a senator from Arizona, very, very conservative, fiscally conservative, socially conservative, who basically defended states' rights, even though he wasn't from the Deep South, but he defended states' rights, opposed to federal government, wanted to cut taxes, wanted to roll back the state, thought that Social Security and the New Deal issues had gone too far, and he wanted to reduce government involvement. And in this battle, famously in the California primaries, to everyone's surprise, Barry Goldwater actually beat Nelson Rockefeller. And during the 1964 conventions, the conservative aspects or the conservative elements within the Republican Party were able to force through Barry Goldwater, and he became the party's nominee. Now, the consequences of that was that in 1964, the Republican Party shifted massively to the right, far further to the right in terms of Goldwater's platform than Johnson and the Democrats had shifted to the left in supporting civil rights. So what ended up happening in the 64 election, it was a contest between the moderate to left-wing Democrats and the legacy of John F. Kennedy after his assassination in 63 versus these almost crazily right-wing conservative Republicans. And the Democrats played very much on this fear that Barry Goldwater was crazy, that he'd just go off launching nuclear bombs all over the place. There was a famous Daisy advert of a girl basically picking the leaves off a daisy, going 1, 2, 10, 9, 8, 7, and it counts down to a nuclear holocaust that blows everything up. The implication being, you know, vote Johnson because Goldwater is crazy and right-wing and he's just going to cause a mess. And what it leads to is the Democrat Party and Johnson win an absolute landslide. Okay, Goldwater only wins in six states, his home state of Arizona and Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia and South Carolina, the states of the Deep South. The problem the Democrats had in reaction to this was that they thought this was a ringing endorsement of the sort of liberal Great Society agenda that Johnson was proposing. Actually, for most Americans, it was fear of Goldwater and a rejection of Goldwater conservatism at that time. The other important thing to notice was that for the first time in history, the Deep South, Louisiana, Mississippi, Georgia, Alabama, and South Carolina had voted for the hated party of Lincoln. And Goldwater had shown, actually, a conservative Republican can win the South. The solid South is not so solid for the Democrats anymore. It's now in play. So, there is a big shift there in Southern politics. We can then fast forward to the 1968 election. And by 1968, we've had the rise of many more social movements. So if 1964 was basically summed up by the civil rights movement knocking the Democrats off the centre and a reaction to that by the southern states and members of the Republican Party, things have gone apace in 1968. As well as the ongoing rise of civil rights issues and the support for them that's grown throughout America, There then comes a white backlash. And that is a large number of white working class people from across America, not just the South. These are in places in the northern states, in cities like New York and Chicago, who feel that civil rights is going too far, that it's actually disadvantaging them. They feel they're being overlooked, and racial intolerance plays a role. So there is this white backlash against the civil rights reform and the Voting Rights Act that have come through in the Johnson era. There is also, by and large, a reaction against the Great Society reforms and the expansion of Social Security and government spending. The late 1960s see the growth in the women's rights movement, although that really comes through in the 70s. But perhaps the biggest social movement that grows throughout the 60s is the anti-war movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement. And that becomes a major defining issue. And all these things start tipping the two main parties off the centre ground. Now, the anti-war movement has a big consequence for the Democrat Party. Civil rights has already torn the Democrat Party in half, and they've lost a big chunk of the Southern support. So they've lost that conservative wing. But in 1968, in the early primaries, a senator called Eugene McCarthy runs in opposition to Johnson. Johnson, who was running for re-election in early 1968, obviously pro-war, pro-Vietnam War, there for the prosecution of it. Eugene McCarthy challenges Johnson and actually manages to defeat him in some of the early primaries and pick up a lot of support. This spooks Johnson. Johnson therefore announces he's not going to stand for re-election, he's just going to stop as president now. And that encourages Bobby Kennedy, John F. Kennedy's younger brother, to throw his hat into the ring. And he starts contesting these primaries. And he starts winning them because of the Kennedy name, because of his positions. And he ends up sort of bypassing Eugene McCarthy, all on the anti-war platform, until eventually he wins a huge number of delegates at the California primary. And of course, sadly, as many of you might know, it was in leaving this reception for his success after the California primaries that he was assassinated and died, removing him from the potential nomination. However, Eugene McCarthy was still there. And we'll get to the convention in 1968, where the Democrat Party, and there's riots in the streets of Chicago, and there's almost riots in the middle of the convention floor. And something very significant for electoral politics happens there. Eugene McCarthy, representing the anti-war wing of the Democrats, has, if you include Bobby Kennedy's anti-war primary victories, has basically got all the primary delegates behind him. But in 1968, the primaries mean nothing. They are purely advisory. And so there is this debate between the supporters of Eugene McCarthy and Bobby Kennedy and the anti-war movement and the more established Democrat Party leadership. And the established Democrat Party leadership end up nominating or selecting a man called Hubert Humphreys to be the Democrat nominee in 1968. Hubert Humphreys had been Johnson's vice president. He was very much in the pro-war camp. This causes outrage in the Democrat Party. They become divided over the issue of the war, and they feel that their voice hasn't been heard. Now, there's a lot of social issues going through. There's a lot of sort of politics in the way the party is set up, and it's infiltrated by a lot of young pro-reform, anti-war strategists and politicians. What they managed to set up in reaction to the 1968 convention is a committee, an investigation or a commission that will investigate the way presidential candidates are nominated. Now, Humphreys, while being very pro-war, is also very pro-civil rights. And basically, a southern wing of the Democrat Party effectively completely bolted here. And they would back a third party challenge by the Alabama governor George Wallace. Now, Wallace was a huge, well, he fought as states' rights. He was a massive segregationist. He famously had stood in the doorways of Alabama State University, saying, "I will not let them in." You know, he will not let black students pass. He would not defend them or protect them. Although it didn't mean anything in the end. But anyway, so he was very much against racial tolerance. And he wanted to defend the Southern way of life and states' rights, very much in the conservative mould for the South. To everyone's surprise as well, on the Republican side, Richard Nixon got the nomination. So he was back from obscurity and running on a more right-wing and a more conservative agenda than he'd run in 1960. So he's come back and he's running on a plan, not so much of supporting the war, but of a special plan he had to finish the war. So he's sort of covering the middle ground there. So, what we have in 1968 is effectively a three-party competition. You've got Richard Nixon, moderate conservative Republican. You've got Hubert Humphreys, pro-war but generally moderate to liberal Democrat. And then you've got what's called the American Independent Party, which is basically George Wallace's segregation party, campaigning on a very conservative and essentially anti-segregation platform. And in terms of results, it's a comfortable win in the Electoral College for Nixon. Nixon wins across most of the USA, and he gets 301 Electoral College votes. Hubert Humphreys only picks up 191, and George Wallace picks up 45. And those states are all in the South. He picks up Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia. While Hubert Humphreys is able to hold on to Texas, that's the only state in the South that he manages to hold. The other ones are the northeastern liberal states and Washington state, Minnesota and Michigan as well. So if you like, the liberal working class areas with high urban densities that Democrats have come to rely on. So it shows that the Democrat Party have lost the Southern conservative vote. But it's not yet loyally for the Republican Party. Yes, they'd voted Goldwater, who was extremely conservative, but they hadn't quite yet gone for the Republican Party as a matter of course. If you look at the percentage of votes that were cast nationally, 43% went to the Republicans, 43.4% to Nixon, 42.7% went to Hubert Humphreys, and 13.5% went to George Wallace. And George Wallace's support wasn't confined in terms of national vote just to the South. There were plenty of other white backlash candidates or working class white men who had supported George Wallace in other states. Perhaps that was enough to tip the state towards Nixon rather than towards Humphrey. So it might have made the balance of power difference there. We'll never know for sure. But it sets a precedence there. First of all, Hubert Humphreys, having lost, having been too centrist, showed that the party bosses in the Democrat Party got it wrong, and it leads to greater calls and greater support for the McGovern Commission, which will review how candidates are selected. At the same time, it shows that the Democrats lost by being too centrist, so there was an argument that to win back the presidency, they needed to become more liberal. There's also, though, a change in focus. Nixon looks at the results, and he looks at his 43.5%, and he looks at Humphrey's 42.5%, and traditional politics would say you try and win over the other guy's support, you appeal to the middle ground, and you try and pick off their votes. But Nixon looked at it, and he looked at the 13.5% that George Wallace had picked up and made the not unreasonable situation that George Wallace's conservative southern voters and white backlash voters from the northern states, plus his own conservative supporters, equals 57% of the electorate. So from Nixon's point of view, and the Republican Party generally, there was much more to be gained for them appealing to George Wallace and his southern voters by being conservative in office than there was appealing to the Democrats and trying to win over some of their liberal support by compromising. And that's what sets the partisan tone for the 1970s. Nixon starts looking at it, the Republicans start looking and realising if they want to be really successful nationally, they need to go more conservative to pick up George Wallace's 13% of the vote. So the writing is kind of on the wall here for the Democrats. They didn't win with a centrist candidate. They start believing we need a more left-wing candidate, an anti-war candidate, that would have been more successful. But the numbers suggest America, by 1968, is generally shifting more to the right. And Nixon comes up with his much-celebrated Southern strategy of trying to win over the Southern states, the George Wallace voters, to his camp to give himself 57% of the vote, which would guarantee Republican presidencies. Now, what's perhaps interesting about the sort of post-1968 election is the hand-wringing and the frustration that it leads in the Democrat Party, so after Humphrey's defeat. And Democrats have, I suppose, what you might term their Tea Party moment, if we compare it to the modern situation, where they start saying, this is terrible, we need to react, we need to go back to our core principles. The Democrat Party bosses have lost their way. Now, that seems to be a strange claim to be making between 1968 and 1972, when you think of just how dominant the Democrat Party had been in the previous 30 or 40 years. You know, with the exception of Eisenhower, they'd held the presidency since 1932. The Democrat share of the vote was still pretty healthy. And Johnson had won in 64 with 61% of the vote. You know, it's not like they'd been in the doldrums for 12, 20 or 20 years. Yes, the Southern states had left the Democrat Party umbrella, but it wasn't yet clear that they were going to go to the Republicans. However, there was concern coming through in 1968. Despite the legacy, the success that they'd had, people started focusing on the fact that while Johnson had had 61% of the vote in 1964, Hubert Humphrey only got 42.7% 4 years later in 1968. So that is a third of the vote disappearing. Equally, the Solid South had clearly been lost, and that was a huge concern because no Democrat presidential candidate had won without the support of the South since the Civil War. And perhaps the most worrying for the Democrats was nearly a third of the white working class vote, you know, the core voters in the northern urban areas, especially in the liberal northern areas, had cast their votes for Nixon or Wallace. So a third of their traditional white working class base with union support has left them. So the writing's kind of on the wall here, and they need to think about how to win it back. But the argument of, if you like, the movement, the New Left Democrats, as they were called, the New Left, was that they needed to become more left-wing in order to appeal to the Liberals again and to win election. And so when the McGovern-Fraser report comes out saying that to stop another Hubert Humphreys moment, they need to have binding primary elections and caucuses in all the states, and they need to have power rather than delegates making their own decisions, the New Left jumps on it. And also, because of the party defeat in 1968, the party bosses accept the findings of the McGovern Commission. Obviously, Humphreys was a mistake, because he lost the election, and the party leadership sort of accepted that. They also saw the control that the New Left was exerting over the Democrat Party and the need to make some reforms to at least show that they were democratic in their selection. So the Democrat Party for the 1972 election adopts the findings of the McGovern Commission. Bizarrely, after McGovern had been the one to come up with the commission with all these proposals, he was the one who most benefited from it. And McGovern was incredibly liberal, and he won the Democrat Party nomination thanks to the primaries. Now, how did McGovern win the primaries? Well, first of all, he was running again against Hubert Humphrey. So here we've got the liberal wing of the Democrat Party, Jimmy McGovern, sort of a political outsider, running against Mr. Party establishment Hubert Humphreys, former vice president, run as the candidate in 1968. Had it been left to the party bosses as it was in 1968, Hubert Humphreys would almost certainly have got the nomination again, despite his defeat. Nixon might well have been seen as vulnerable. But thanks to McGovern's commission, the party bosses had lost their control, and it was McGovern who would get the nomination. What's perhaps interesting is actually, nationally, if you count up the votes cast in the Democrat primaries, Humphreys actually won. He got 26% of the vote to McGovern's 25%. Unfortunately for Humphreys, that means nothing because McGovern actually won 21 of the state primaries and caucuses, whereas Humphreys only won 5. So McGovern won the delegate count, he got the majority, and he got the nomination. And the Democrat Party, having lost control of the nomination, are forced to support a much more liberal candidate than they would otherwise. So big effects of the primaries there. And what's the reaction to this? Well, Nixon, being centrist to conservative and appealing to the southern base, ends up winning 60.7% of the national vote. George McGovern ends up winning 37.5% and actually only carries one state, the state of Massachusetts. And what we have here is a complete inverse of 1964. In 1964, you had the Goldwater Revolution and a massive shift to the right, which terrified most moderate Americans and led to the Republicans being heavily defeated. The Democrats, by opening up their primaries to popular partisan passions and the sort of really liberal, energized wing of the new left, have now gone for an extreme left-wing candidate, leaving the more moderate to conservative Republicans to win a win 49 of the states in the Electoral College. And that kind of shows the power that the primaries have for shifting the parties, because it was the primaries, by making them binding and by allowing hardcore activists and movement Democrats, movement liberals, to take control of the nomination process away from the more moderate party leaders, shift the Democrat Party much further to the left in 1972. Nixon, in his Southern strategy, has moved the Republican Party further to the right, but not as far off centre as the Democrats have gone. So Nixon wins here. Despite moving to the right, he wins because people are more terrified of this far left figure of Jimmy McGovern. But it shows that the introduction of primaries are going to help fuel a growing divide between the two main parties. And if we go back to the 57% of the vote in 1968 that Nixon and Wallace gained, and we then look at the 60% of the vote that Nixon gained without a Wallace third party challenge by winning all the states of the South, we can see that American politics has shifted more to the right, and that there is a clear divide coming through between the Democrats and the Republicans on national issues, and they've been tilted off centre by major social movements. So the dividing lines have been drawn, and the two parties are set. The Democrats shifting further to the left, whilst the Republicans shift further to the right. And a clear partisan divide will begin to grow. However, at this stage, there is still a lot of centre ground, and there is a lot of overlap between the two parties. Now, this overlap will really start to disappear in the 1980s. But it was all there in the 1970s. So next time, we're going to look at the Reagan Revolution and how Reagan, who is seen as the one who really created the far-right shift of the Republican Party that's really exacerbated the partisan divide. But it's worth bearing in mind that Conservative Party divide and that shift to the right was there in 1972. And actually, had it not been for Watergate, which completely muddied the issue, the chances are the Republican Party would have continued going further to the right, and the Democrats may have shifted further to the left had it not been for Watergate and the various issues that it then exacerbated. But that's for next time when we look at the 70s. The thing to remember is during the 1960s and into the 70s, we shift from a period of bipartisan cooperation between the two main parties to a clear ideological division, with the Democrats shifting to the left and the party bosses losing control of their own nomination process, whilst the Republicans, in a bid to win the South, win the conservative voters of the South, the Dixiecrats, as they were, to the Republican fold, shift socially further to the right. So the dividing lines are drawn and the birth of partisan politics in the modern era begins by after 1968 and is set by 1972, and it's only going to start growing wider. I hope that's been useful, and I hope you'll join me again next time when we look at the 1970s and 80s and into the early 90s for the growth of the partisan divide. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll speak to you next time.